I'm not going to officially convene the meeting since we don't have a quorum yet, but I want to get started. I'll officially convene the meeting when we do. We have before us Commissioner Peggy Ingeson and our state economist, Dr. Tom Stinson, to review the forecast that was released yesterday. Welcome back to the committee. Who would like to go first?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I think you probably have a packet of charts with you. You should have a packet of charts as well as a summary of the forecast book. And we're going to run through those and we can use the overhead if actually or not, because if everybody has the packet of charts, that's okay.
It may be easier to follow along on the overhead for some people if you can do that.
How do we turn this on? Okay, there we go.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and members, this would be the first chart in your packet, and to just talk to you about, first of all, Mr. Chair, I'm Peggy Ingeson, Commissioner of Finance, with me here today as well as Tom Stinson, the state economist. And Jim Showalter, the State Budget Director and Assistant Commissioner, who will, Jim will talk a little bit about the spending changes, and Tom will talk about the economic issues and the revenue changes, and I'll just give a few comments on a couple of overhead slides here. Broad overview, this forecast that we updated here in February and announced yesterday is updating to our November forecast that we produced. This forecast actually covers three bienniums, the current 04-05, the upcoming 06-07, where we're working on budget development for the 06-07 budget, and then the planning estimates for 08-09 are included in this as well. First, I talk here on the slide on the bottom of the first page there, and that's up on the screen here. This is our projected balance now for fiscal year 2005. And as you can see, there's actually $175 million in forecast improvement. And as you can see from the slide, about the bulk of it, $157 million is on the revenue side. And Tom will talk a little bit about the components and what's actually going on there. There's a modest change in expenditures. One key piece of action is the deficiency bill that passed in between the November forecast and its February forecast. The effect of that is included in this forecast in 04-05. And as you can see on the bottom, the $25 million that was reduced from the budget reserve, that was the financing for the deficiency bill. So a total change there of $175 million. Next, chart on the top of the next page describes how this is all allocated under current law. So the balance of $175 million as in November with that forecast is allocated. First, the $25 million goes into restoring the budget reserve, bringing that back up to $653 million. Again, this is the money that was used to fund the deficiencies in the bill enacted in between the forecasts. The next $150 million goes to pay back the school payment shift. And, Mr. Chairman, just a quick little bit of history and members. In 2002 and 2003, both of those sessions, we took action to change the payments, the way we make payments to school districts. And prior to 2002, we were on a 90% payment of the school district revenues in the current year and 10% settling up in the following year. We changed that in order to generate budget savings to balance our budget to 80% in the current year, 20% as the settle-up payment in the following year. But at the same time, we included information or included this requirement in law to say we need to get back to that because we know that that's not good for our long-term financial management. So these triggers in the forecast will automatically buy back the school payment shift. So in November, we went from 80% to 81.9%, and now with this $150 million in this forecast, we'll be going to 84.3%, a again with 15.7% is the settle-up payment in the following year. And Mr. Chairman and members, the goal in statute is to get back to that 90% paid in the current year, and that would actually cost an additional about $350 million. The next chart shows the biennium that, as we're in the process of developing the budget for the 06-07 biennium, and when we reported to you in November a gap of $700 million, that has now been reduced to $466 million. Again, this is the upcoming budget biennium, and the expenditures here on this chart don't include the effect of inflation. That would actually add another $700 million to that gap. But to report at this point, the February forecast has an improvement of $234 million. That's entirely on the revenue side. The spending estimates from November are virtually unchanged. And I guess just a point to make here is that even though obviously $234 million is a lot of money, this is a really modest forecast change. It's a very slight change. It's 0.8% change in our forecast. And with that, Tom Stinson will talk a little bit now about the economy and the revenue changes.
Excuse me, I first want to congratulate you on your projections for spending. I don't think I've ever seen a spending forecast that had no change at all. I understand that there is a slight change in that, was it $80,000 difference or something like that, but that's pretty amazing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Obviously, there actually are a lot of things underlying ups and downs, but I think it is kind of remarkable that it hit on the mark that... You're right, it doesn't usually happen.
And I think actually it's kind of remarkable if you can get within 1% in general, too. But I don't think I've ever seen one where it was zero. Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, the message from this forecast really is that there are only very, very small changes. There are just really no changes in the U.S. economic outlook. There are very small changes in the Minnesota economic outlook, and there are very small changes in the outlook for state revenues. There's been a very small change in the outlook for wages in the state. Consumer spending and business equipment, the sales tax base, have increased slightly. Corporate profits have decreased. The forecast for corporate profits have decreased slightly. But again, these are very small changes. If you look at the graph that's on the screen, this shows real GDP growth through the end of calendar 2007. And what you can see is two things. One is that there's good growth projected, 3% or more on out through the entire forecast horizon. And it actually extends on to 2008 and 2009. That 3% growth is a little bit stronger than we thought was possible in the late 1980s and early 1990s, when it was generally considered that if you had 2.5% growth, that would be as fast as the economy could handle. Now, it's not quite as strong as in 2004, but 2004 was just a few one-hundredths of a percentage point off in growth rate from being the strongest economy in 20 years. So, you know, this is still a very optimistic, very strong forecast for the national economy. It's a forecast through 2005 that almost all forecasters agree with, and that there is not much difference in the outlooks of major forecasters through 2005. Everybody thinks that this situation is pretty well set for the national economy, absent some big shock, terrorist event, some kind of a shock to the dollar or something like that. But other than that, this economy looks pretty well set through 2005, probably through early 2006. The place where there's some concern is later in 2006 as higher interest rates begin to take effect and could slow business investment and could slow the economy. Looking on.
Excuse me, Dr. Stinson, first the question. I think that the final numbers or the latest estimates for the fourth quarter came out probably after this was already put together. Can you talk at all? Were those a little bit higher than these final estimates then, or how did that, or is that already adjusted in here?
No, fourth quarter GDP, there are three estimates that come out. There's an advance estimate, a preliminary estimate, and a final estimate. The advance estimate was for 3.1% real GDP growth. That was what the February forecast was based on. The preliminary estimate, which comes after the advance estimate, was 3.8% real GDP growth. That will be in Global Insight's March forecast, and then there will be a final adjustment again. This 7/10% change in the real GDP is a significant change, and one would think that that might change the outlook and improve the outlook a little bit, except that a lot of that was due to a mistake in the Canadian trade data that was put into the national economic accounts. And that mistake was acknowledged prior to the February forecast being put together. And so some of that was already in Global Insight's thinking in there. So we don't expect a huge change in the outlook because of the change in the GDP numbers.
Well, thank you, Dr. Stinson. And if I can just break for a minute, we now do have a quorum, so I'm going to officially call the meeting to order. Clerk will note the roll. Members, we have the minutes of the February 28th meeting before us. Are there any corrections, additions, or changes to the minutes? Representative McNamara moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of the minutes being approved, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Wagenius, do you have a question?
I do, Mr. Chair. You were talking about recent data that came out, and I was going to ask about the recent data. I think the inflation number for January came out today. Am I right about that?
Dr. Spencer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, I honestly don't know. There's some other data that came out today that I was looking at, and so I haven't looked at the inflation numbers. Can you tell me what they were?
I think it was higher than expected, and that's why I was going to ask about it. If I wish I had read more carefully, because I expected you to know it. I think it was 0.3. Would that be right?
I don't think so.
No.
But it could have been. I mean.
Well, I guess we need to go get the newspaper, don't we?
Yeah.
And ask what it is. I'll do that, actually, because I want to know how it fits in with the 1.7 that this budget is predicated on, which seems low to me.
Dr. Simpson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenius, the explanation for the what appears to be a low inflation rate provided by Global Insight for 2000, actually 2005, for 2005 they have 2.3% CPI rate in there, so that's not the 1.7 that you're talking about. The average 06 and 07. 06 and 07. And how it can get down to 1.7% there. There are two ways that it can get down.
I'm looking at page 3 here.
Yeah. That's the average for 2006 and 2000, fiscal 2006 and 2007. And for fiscal 2005, the inflation rate that's used by Global Insight is 2.3%. There are two ways it can get down, or two reasons why that can be lower. The first is that Global Insight has a forecast for oil prices that are declining. They are $45 per barrel this summer, $40 a barrel by the end of 2005, $35 a barrel by the end of 2006. So that lower oil price has an effect on the inflation, and it offsets increases that would come from other areas like lower value of the dollar and the effect on imports, for example. The second reason why the CPI might be expected to slow and is expected to slow is that the Federal Reserve is in the process of tightening the economy, tightening down on interest rates, tightening the money supply, raising interest rates. That should be, other things equal, a factor that would slow the economy down slightly. And going back to this graph here, you do see that the economy slows down by 2006 in terms of growth rate just a little bit. That takes some of the inflationary pressure off, in theory at least. And what is hoped is that an increase in demand from foreign consumers, an increase in export demand, offsets the decline in domestic demand, and that's what keeps the economy moving forward at a steady rate on into the future. Now, that's it's kind of two precarious assumptions maybe that you have there, but that's what the scenario is, that the Federal Reserve tightens, that slows the domestic economy down, that slows inflation down as well, and then the value of the dollar makes suddenly U.S. goods more competitive, and so foreign countries start buying more U.S. goods, and that causes the U.S. economy to continue to grow at the same rate.
Representative Guinness.
Thank you. I think when you say that there's some precarious assumptions here, you're right on. So it seems to me that as we view this, having a one number, 1.7, is not particularly helpful, that it would be more helpful for us to see a range. I mean, you can have a point in a range and say we expect it to be 1.7, but if we had a range of inflation, and then we could say if inflation was at 1.8 or 2.1, this is what kind of debt we would have. And so it's hard for us to make a judgment without seeing a range. Most of the kinds of things we see nowadays are in ranges and not in just absolute points with a, this is it, guys, because we do have some pretty precarious assumptions here. So is that something you all provide us with? You must have that kind of documentation. I would assume you have that kind of documentation, that if inflation were to be different, what kind of deficit that would give to us. Do you have those things you could share with us?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have the estimate as to what kind of a structural deficit that would create. The contractor that we have for the national forecast, Global Insight, does provide two alternative scenarios. One is a more optimistic scenario, and one is a less optimistic scenario. Now, in the more optimistic scenario, which is a lower inflation scenario and higher productivity, and it's assigned a 20% probability by them, for 2005, the inflation rate, the consumer prices increased by 1.7%, and in 2006 they grow by only 1%. So for fiscal 06, one could maybe take the average of those two or something like that, you know, if you were going to do some quick arithmetic, and then for fiscal 07, it's back up to 1.6%. their less optimistic scenario or their more pessimistic scenario is in a scenario where inflation really does take off on you. They have 2.4% inflation in 2005, 2.8% inflation in 2006, and 3% inflation in 2007. Now that has, again, some very heavy assumptions about what happens to oil prices and what happens to productivity and all those kinds of things as well, which are an alternative but are not necessarily any more realistic than the assumptions that are in the baseline scenario. That scenario is also assigned a 20% probability. And so the baseline scenario that we have here really is pretty much in the middle between the two alternatives, and this gives you some idea of what the alternatives are, what kind of upside and downside potential there is because of them.
Do you mind if I follow up?
Oh, please, go ahead.
Well, if there's 20% upside and 20% downside, then it seems to me we've got 60% chance that the 1.7 is going to be right on. Is that right? Or am I getting that wrong?
Well, I think if you say it was going to be right on, 60% chance.
Is 60% about the right way of looking at it?
60% is the probability that's assigned to the control scenario, yes.
Right. I think it will be helpful, given the precariousness and the 60%, that we have an ability to view, even just slightly on either side of inflation, what the outcomes for Minnesota would be. I just don't think we can operate without that. But the second thing, one of the assumptions that you didn't talk about, and I would like to understand, is what federal debt was assumed as they were making their inflation assumptions?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenes. The federal, I can tell you the exact numbers that are there, but they're not probably not meaningful. What they're assuming is roughly the CBO numbers, looking on out into the future for 2005, 2006, 2007. Now, as you extend beyond looking out 2008, 2009, they believe that there is going to have to be some kind of tax increase, bring the budget situation a little bit more under control. But in the short term, it's very similar to the CBO numbers.
Representative Wagenes.
Well, do the CBO numbers assume the budget debt that the president has proposed? Do they assume the debt we might take on with Social Security?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wagenes, the CBO numbers are current law numbers, and so they don't make adjustment for any of the president's budget actions or any future tax changes as well, and they don't take on, they don't make any assumption about the potential increase in the budget deficit for Social Security.
Yeah.
These are current law assumptions, and that's what the Congressional Budget Office has to do. Now, with respect to the assumptions about taking on $2 trillion worth of debt for Social Security, that's outside the immediate forecast horizon.
Representative Wagenes.
But the budget that Congress may enact this year is within the horizon. Mm-hmm. And so what you're saying, it's not the president's budget proposal, but it is exactly what we have in place right now that uses the projection. Okay.
Dr. Stinson.
Representative Gaines, what we have right now in law, now there are entitlements, and so just as the state expenditure forecast increases, even without an automatic inflation increase in there, because of caseload and things like that, those entitlements would all go up, and there are projections for increases in Social Security and all of that. So it's not purely a no flat.
Thank you.
Representative Solberg.
That's okay.
Dr. Stinson, back to you.
Okay. The Minnesota economy, our forecast for the Minnesota economy is, again, for much of the same as we've seen in the last year or so. The forecast calls for 44,000 jobs being added between the fourth quarter of 2004 and the fourth quarter of 2005, or about 11,000 jobs per quarter. Now, when we did this forecast was based on information that was available at the end of January and early February. Today, some different information came out on jobs, and this graph that I have here is no longer an accurate graph because there have been revisions to the data back actually for a number of years, not just for 2004. This graph, or the data that we had here, showed that Minnesota's economy had added 23,000 jobs between January of or December of 2003 and December of 2004. But 18,000 of those jobs had been added before May, and that we've only added 5,000 jobs since May. What the new data shows is that we added 36,000 jobs in 2004, and this is a little bit more complicated graph, but what it shows, if you look at the focus on the difference between the crosshatched lines and the black line, it shows what's happened, what the differences are, what the revisions to the forecast were. And what you can see is that instead of plateauing in May, the economy, employment in Minnesota actually grew through the summer and then plateaued in August and September. And since that time, it's been relatively flat. Now, there are a couple of items that are of interest in and should be of interest to members of this committee in this change in the forecast or in the data. The first is that between December and January, we lost. Let me make sure I have the right numbers because we just got these numbers a little while ago. We lost 5,600 jobs between December and January. And on average, I mean, that's a pretty scary number to find out that you lost 5,600 jobs. However, if you look at the data, what you also see is that December was revised up by 5,600 jobs. And so actually where we are in January is not 5,600 jobs before where we were before we got this revision and when we did the forecast, but we're still roughly flat compared to where we were when we did the forecast. Now, that's certainly not good news. We're in a situation where we're expecting to gain 3,000 jobs per month, but keeping both the revision and the new information in mind, it's not quite as bad as one might have thought. We only have to make up 3,000 jobs rather than 9,000 jobs in this forecast.
Representative Solberg.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Dr. Stinson, I don't have the numbers in front of me, although I did look at that revised chart a couple of hours ago. And it also seems to me that in the revised chart that the labor force as a whole dropped down in Minnesota, like from December to January, like 3,000 people were out of the labor force. Were not seeking employment or employed. The total, I think I'm correct on that. And does that reflect then people who have moved out of state? Does that reflect people who have run out of unemployment and are no longer a statistic because of that? Or is it, what causes the labor force to go down? I thought, a significant number.
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, first of all, it's important to remember that this is a sample, and it's a relatively small sample, and so movements of that much in the labor force, while not common, are not totally impossible just because of sampling errors. So that's the first thing to remember. The second point is that the reason why the labor force, this household survey that you're talking about, occurs in the following way. That what happens is that people are selected at random. They're asked, are you working? If they answer no, they ask, are you looking for work? If you answer yes, then you're counted as part of the labor force. If you answer no, you're counted as not being part of the labor force. You're just counted as part of the general population that's not looking for work. Now, what that means is that you can have people drop out of the labor force because they're discouraged workers, because the jobs just aren't out there, and so they've given up and are not looking for work. Or you can have people drop out of the labor force because of other reasons.
Retirement.
Yeah, retirement or whatever. So that's what's going on. These numbers are pretty volatile and move quite a bit. It was, though, a little disturbing to note that Minnesota's December unemployment rate was raised from 4.4 to 4.6%, and that Minnesota's unemployment rate for January was 4.4%. Now, that's still 0.8% less than the U.S. average rate, and that's good, but we're used to Minnesota being about 1.5% below the U.S. rate. So it's another sign that Minnesota's economy is not producing quite the right amount of jobs at this point.
Then one other question of that, and that is, do we have any indications other than the collection of income tax of the type of jobs that are being created when we see, and that probably hasn't happened yet, but when we see people in professions such as the buyers from Marshall Fields, if they potentially lose their job, that's a good-paying job, and the people in Blandon that were laid off were good-paying jobs, and what kind of creation of jobs are being created? Are they less pay? Is there a pay differential in those? Are we able to track that at all?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Solberg, we are able to track that some, maybe not to the degree that you would like, but there is some information that we have. We know what industries the jobs are being created in. And one of the interesting things about this change in employment that is notable, or is noted, or that we can see in the revisions is, and I think I said this before, that from December to December, before we thought there had been 23,000 jobs created, and instead it turns out that there have been 38,000 jobs created in Minnesota over that period under the revised data. Now, the question is, where did the additional jobs come from? What sectors did they come from? They came from three sectors primarily: manufacturing, retail trade, and business and professional services. We actually ended up with 4,000 more manufacturing jobs in Minnesota at the end of 2004 than we thought there were yesterday. That's obviously good news, because those are the kinds of jobs that we want in the state that are, you know, good paying jobs. The business and professional services area, which is another relatively high paying job sector, we had been underperforming in the previous data. We've been underperforming the U.S. average. We're still underperforming the U.S. average in growth in that, I think, at this point. But we added 3,200 jobs there. And the other 7,000 jobs were added in retail, trade, and transportation and utilities. And I suspect probably a lot of that was in the retail trade area, but I don't know.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Well, the question that one might have is, what would this mean for the forecast? Or is there much of it? Is this change that we saw significant for the forecast? And the answer is that we wouldn't know unless we did a new forecast. But if you look at this graph, which provides a little bit more perspective as to what's happened with Minnesota versus the U.S., what the data revisions show us is that 2003 was a little weaker. If you look at the black line with the white circles on it and compare that to the lighter colored line with the square boxes on it, you can see that Minnesota during 2003 really didn't grow in employment, and we had thought that the state had grown in employment a little bit. Then in April we're roughly at the U.S. level. We're roughly at the old level. We bounce up and we get to the U.S. level by May. Then we show kind of gradual growth, but there's still quite a gap between the U.S. and Minnesota by the time we reach the end of December and the end of January. So the changes probably aren't material. They might add or take away a few million dollars, but this isn't enough. The information is probably not sufficient it's insufficient to change our attitude toward the forecast. One of the reasons why we're confident about the forecast, or why we were confident about the job growth, is some relatively recent information that we have in terms of unemployment, initial unemployment claims, and active unemployment claims. Here, what we have is continuing unemployment claims, this graph, and this graph shows that there's a seasonal pattern to the number of people that are on unemployment. In the summer, in the good year, which was 1999-2000, before the recession hit, statewide there were about 25,000 people on unemployment on average in any week in the summer. It dips down a little bit in October and early November, and then during the winter it goes up, and it went up to about 55,000 or 60,000, then kind of trended back down in over the spring, and that was back down to 25,000 in the fall. When the recession hit, active unemployment claims actually just about doubled. More people were unemployed. You can see those curves there. They have the same pattern, the same seasonal pattern, but they're about twice as big. Then if you look at the small round circles starting out about to the far right of the graph, about April and May, you can see there was a divergence. The economy got a little stronger. The number of active unemployment claims fell. It was only about two-thirds as much, fell about a third of the gap between the two. And then the heavier black circles, which are starting in the 2004-2005 fiscal year, you see they stayed, they kept that same gap for a while, and then November, December, early January, they began to pull closer to the bad years of 2001, 2002, and 2003. But over the last month, you can see that that trend has changed and that we've leveled off and there's a gap that's appearing again. So our thought, and again, when you're talking about turning points in an economy and things like that, it's always something that you do with a little trepidation. But our thought is that this provides some support for our thought that we'd have stronger economic growth and we'd be able to make that 44,000 jobs. Now, I want to show you real quickly a graph that isn't in your packet.
Excuse me, before we do that, Representative Carlson's got a question.
Mr. Chairman, may you just it's kind of a follow-up, I think, to some of what Representative Solberg was asking, but relative to this chart, active unemployment claim. How are we measuring the people that have, because we've had such a long recession, used all of their unemployment claim rights, they've run out of their unemployment, when we say this is active? I know you said that Representative Solberg's questioning that you do a representative sampling of those who are actively seeking work, but how much of this would be driven by people simply having consumed their unemployment benefits and therefore the active claims drop?
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Stinson.
Carlson, we track that separately. Each week there's information on the number of people that have exhausted their unemployment claims over that period, too, and there wasn't any significant change in the number of people that had exhausted unemployment claims. And so we think that this is a pretty clean number. I want to show you another graph that provides some support for that number, and that is something that's a lot busier, and you have to look at it on the screen. But this is initial unemployment claims. So these are people that are applying for unemployment for the first time. And again, there's that seasonal pattern, lower in the summer, higher in the winter, and then there's this good year of 1999-2000. And then up here you can see the, you know, roughly again twice as many applying for unemployment at any time during the recession years and the post-recession years. And again, it's kind of noisy here, and you know, it's not as smooth as the other graph. But what I want you to look at and to focus on here is what's happening to initial unemployment claims this fiscal year. And here you can see that we were a little bit below, and we kind of came back and we tracked right on, and then we actually tracked right on, had about the same number of initial unemployment claims as we did during the recession years and the immediate post-recession years in November and December, and early January even had a very high unemployment claim week. But then look what's happened the last month or so. Initial unemployment claims have dropped, and they've dropped down well below the poorer years, and they're back kind of on this good year path. So that again leads us, you know, all of this is kind of forensic economics, and what we're doing is trying to figure out what, from all the clues, what's going on. But this is another clue that lends support to the fact that that change in continuing claims is real, and that we should be seeing that in the employment statistics, you know, in the next month or so. The unemployment statistics are collected on the week of the 12th, always on the week that has the 12th in it. And so that was early in January. And looking at this, you can see that that may have been about the weakest point in terms of initial unemployment claims as well.
Thank you, Dr. Simpson. Go ahead.
moving on here, talk real quickly about the forecast. The forecast here, what? The forecast, the income tax, very small change, 0.5%. The sales tax, very small change again, 1.3%, but $50 million of that is change in sales tax refunds, not change in gross sales tax receipts. So when you look at what actually happened to gross sales tax receipts, they're only up by 0.7%, $64 million. Corporate income tax is up $89 million or 6.4%. What's really happened there is that we had smaller refunds and higher estimated payments in the fourth quarter than we had anticipated in November. So a lot of the money that we took out in the November forecast on the corporate income tax has been put back in. Not all of it, but a substantial portion of it. Motor vehicle sales tax is down $19 million from forecast, or 3.5%. That we're concerned about that estimate. I mean, we believe this is the right estimate, but of all the parts of the forecast that could go wrong, this one seems like one that could go wrong in a bigger fashion this time, and so we're a little bit concerned that may be too strong an estimate, and that there might even be less motor vehicle sales tax than that. Other revenues down $22 million. That includes a $15 million positive gain for the tobacco settlement funds that we've had. So all in all, $234 million more in the revenue forecast for 2006-2007, 0.8% change from November's estimate.
Representative Carlson.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to the corporate income tax, because we had, you know, in previous meetings quite a bit of discussion about the problem we were having collecting corporate taxes, and at least the testimony you just gave didn't seem to indicate that we had solved that problem. Or another way of putting it, have we identified what the problem was?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson.
Dr. Stinson.
The corporate income tax, there were two parts to it. One was lower than expected refunds, and that appears to be just something that happened, that appears to reflect better corporate profits, although when you're dealing with corporate refunds, there's always the possibility that there is a large refund that's somehow under litigation or under examination or something like that, and you know, you could show up with a $20 million refund 2 days from now or tomorrow, and it wouldn't be a shock. Part of that does appear that 2003 corporate profits were probably a little stronger than was in the forecast. On the estimated tax payment side, until we get the tax return, we really won't know what's going on there. And the tax return for tax year 2004 probably won't be submitted until, for most corporations, won't be submitted until late this summer. And so it will be a while before we can really do very much in the way of analysis on that. We know that for the third quarter that there were some unusual events dealing with merger and acquisition of a major corporation that was headquartered in the Twin Cities. And so we know that was a one-time event. At this point, we haven't been able to identify any one-time events that have affected the fourth quarter, but there still could be smaller events that we just aren't aware of that have gone on.
Dr. Simpson, I guess following up on that, the corporate income tax, how much did we take out of the November forecast for the next 2 years back in November. I mean, I know that you were very concerned about the numbers. Can you tell me how much we took out?
I think the number we took out was $142 million.
Okay, and so
we put about 60% of it back in.
Okay, so you're putting about 60% of it back in. Okay. And then on the other revenues, if you've actually got $15 million of a positive gain for tobacco in there, and that would imply that you're really down $37 million, not counting that. Where is most of that shortfall coming?
Mr. Chairman, most of that shortfall is coming from regional treatment center revenue. And it's a complicated story, and maybe somebody else can explain it better than I, but the regional treatment center revenue is down because of a slowdown in the transition to community-based centers. Is that the right term?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman and members, the amount that we had estimated for receipts coming into the general fund for regional treatment center receipts assumed that there would be a faster transition away from regional treatment centers into group homes, and further had assumed that most of these would still be state-operated services. And now many of them are private providers. And so there's a sizable decrease in receipts for that change.
Hey, Commissioner, that's all happened in 3 months. I mean, since November, we've suddenly found that we have a lot more private providers running our regional treatment centers than we thought we had 3 months ago.
Mr. Chairman, it's a change in the assumption. It's not necessarily that all of the action has occurred in these last 3 months. But I think it's both a combination of both a slower transition and the understanding that there are private providers that are providing that service and that it's not just state-operated services.
So I'm trying to understand. So what you're saying is that your projection is that there are going to be a lot fewer people paying us fees through insurance or whatever in regional treatment centers over the next 2 years because of these other private providers getting the money instead, or at least providing the service instead. We're not going to have as many people in our RTCs paying fees to their insurance company or whatever because they're going to be in other places.
Mr. Chairman, this is like the movement from regional treatment centers to community-based services. So the assumption initially was that it would be difficult for these to get people to provide these services, and so it was assumed that there would be, even though they're community services, they'd be state operated, and in fact there are more that are being provided privately.
Okay.
And as well, Mr. Chair, as the transition is a little bit slower.
And so, Commissioner, are we picking up money on the expense side then in that area?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure of the interactions on the expense side there because I'm just not sure. And maybe Mr. Showalter can answer that better.
Representative Gunther, I see you have your hand up. Maybe you can answer that.
I can't answer that question. I have a different one, Mr. Chairman.
All right. If you have a different question, go ahead and ask it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Simpson, I noticed that corporate income taxes are substantially up. And that's, I assume, above what was expected. We had a lot of discussion about offshoring and corporations hiding their money in foreign countries. Does this kind of negate that possibility a little bit?
Dr. Stinson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, I don't think it does. The growth that we had in corporate income tax receipts compared to the growth in corporate profits. Corporate profits grew way faster than corporate income tax receipts. And so I think that foreign operating corporations are still a problem for the state and for other states that have similar tax structures to Minnesota.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there any way that we can, to me, having this big increase shows that I think bringing those profits back or what?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunter, there are, well, there are other corporations that are not engaging in foreign operating corporation behavior, and what we've seen is that those corporations are having larger increases in profits. Now, there's another question, which I'm not sure whether it's a question you're asking or not, and that's part of the tax bill last fall called a lot or provided for firms being able to repatriate profits at a low rate, federal tax rate. And if your question is that what's going on here, the answer is no, because this was fourth quarter 2004 behavior, and that law doesn't apply until 2005, and that is in the forecast.
Very good point. Thank you.
Mr. Showalter, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director at the Department of Finance. If you'll go to the next chart, you'll see that there is a little change in the forecast spending associated with this.
Mr. Showalter, before you go on to that, I was thinking you were going to answer the question that I asked Ms. Ingeson, Commissioner Ingeson, but if you're not going to do that, I got one other question for Dr. Stinson on the last chart. So can I do that?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, as he comes back to the desk, I'll answer your question. We got information that there is a small decrease in spending in this forecast associated with the delay or the changes in the state-operated services movement to community settings, about $4 million, and it shows up in the Medicaid budget, the medical assistance budget. Otherwise, there's not a significant spending change. Most of this is happening on the revenue side.
So the long and the short of it is we are projected to have a lot fewer people in the RTCs than we projected last time.
We are moving them to community settings slower than anticipated, and the reason that has two effects is that we are going to get more medical assistance, more federal money for some of those services when we move them to community settings. That's why this is mostly on the revenue side.
I see. Okay. They're not moving as fast, so there's going to be more in RTCs. I think I'm finally getting this. There are going to be more people in RTCs than we thought, and we're going to make less money because we get paid more once they're moved somewhere else.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
I got it. All right. Dr. Stinson, the other question I wanted to ask you about is the motor vehicle sales taxes. That's down $19 million, and I guess I wanted to ask if you could comment on that, and you were talking about how you thought it was maybe even there was some potential there it would go down further, and could you talk a little bit about that, how it affects other funds besides just the general fund?
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you know, not all of the motor vehicle sales tax goes to the general fund. I think it's about 32% is all that goes to the general fund, and the rest goes to fund transportation activity. The concern is that motor vehicle sales tax revenues in Minnesota have not followed what we have traditionally used as indicators of potential growth in that tax. The spending on consumer durables, motor vehicles, has held up reasonably well nationally, and yet the tax base in Minnesota has declined. Now, the tax receipts have declined. There are a couple of possibilities here. One is that we're just seeing a situation where Minnesotans have bought more cars in 2003, say, than the U.S. average, and so they're not buying as many as you would expect in 2004, or some kind of a timing thing. Another possibility is that we're extending the length of our cars, the length of time we hold on to our cars, and so we're not buying as rapidly as the U.S. has, or there could be other breaks in structure in there. What we've seen, though, is that in the last couple of quarters, the forecast would lead you to have much lower estimates than we had before. And so that's what we're looking for, is see if there's been some kind of break in structure. There could be more leasing or less leasing going on in the state than nationally. There could be something going on with the way that used car values are factored into the price in there as well. There are a whole series of institutional changes, and it's something that we're looking at and we'll know more. But at this point, it's a little shakier of a revenue source than we had thought it to be.
Thank you. All right, please. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Staff was very kind and brought me a clipping from the New York Times, which talked about the inflation that we've just projected. And now I've given it to Dr. Stinson and can't read it to you, but he can. But safe to say it's above where people expected. And my question is, how, if this pattern were to continue, how long would we go before we would say we've got to revisit this issue of the inflation and how the base we're using in our budgeting?
Dr. Stinson?
Yeah. At this point, the inflation isn't in the budget.
I understand.
And so...
I understand that.
And it seems to me that the question that you asked me earlier is a legitimate thing for legislators to be considering, and that is, what is the appropriate level of inflation that one would think is going to go on, and how are we going to make plans to incorporate that to the extent that we want to into the budget that's being approved. And along with that, of course, we have to think about not just inflation but productivity, because there certainly would be the opportunity to do more with less as well. And how does that balance out? One wouldn't necessarily think just because there was 3% inflation that you would raise spending by 3% to hold things equal, because you might have 1% increase in productivity.
Representative Wagenius.
No, actually, I was looking at the other side, and I'm sorry it wasn't clear. What it would mean for revenue, what it means for our economy if our inflation was running way above or above what we were expecting, what was being projected.
Dr. Stinson.
In terms of the revenues, this is kind of a strange situation in that inflation is actually good for revenues in the short term, because with higher prices, we get more sales tax. With higher prices, people in the private sector tend to get cost of living adjustments in their wages, and so we get more income tax receipts as well. That's not until the Federal Reserve begins to get afraid of inflation and begin to shut the economy down that revenues begin to be affected. Now, the Federal Reserve is already engaged in a process of raising interest rates, trying to keep the inflation under control. Typically, it takes 12 to 18 months for Federal Reserve interest rate actions to begin to take effect, and so one might think that if this suddenly scared Dr. Greenspan and he started raising interest rates 50 basis points instead of 25 basis points, that we would be talking about something 12 to 18 months from now, so it would be mid-2006 to the end of 2006 before the impact on the economy would be really notable. That up to this point, as you probably well know, the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates by 1.5 percentage points or 150 basis points but the key longer-term interest rates really haven't changed.
Yeah.
And this article that you showed me here said, wait a minute, people are beginning to start changing the longer-term interest rates, and that, of course, is what affects the economy, is those longer-term interest rates. And so, you know, back to try and answer your question a little bit, you know, we're talking about a year to 18 months from now.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rukavina.
Just to add points with Dr. Stinson. If inflation is good, as you said, it's kind of a strange situation, but if it's good on the revenue side because it brings in more spending, I mean more sales tax and income tax, net, is it bad not to include it on the spending side?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, the legislature passed a law saying that we couldn't do it. We did it before the legislature passed the law that said that we couldn't do it. If there wasn't that law, I'm sure that we would do it.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Stinson, Dr. Stinson, and Representative Knobloch and members, you know, that asterisk down here in the next slide, understanding kind of reminds me of what Representative Kahn said about the Roger Maris resolution yesterday on the floor. Commissioner Engelson, why do we need an asterisk underspending? Is it for the same reason we needed an asterisk on Roger Maris's home run record?
Mr. Chairman, Dr.
Stinson, you want to comment on the Roger Maris question?
What I'm saying,
sorry, go ahead, Representative Rukavina.
The asterisk was there in the Roger Maris in the home run record book to show that, you know, there was a different
number of
rules.
Games.
There
yep.
were different rules before.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you know, that's the point I'm trying to make. What do we need an asterisk under spending for if it's not to remind all of us that there are different rules, and the rules we're going by today don't make any sense? That's the point I'm trying to make. And Dr. Stinson's smiling up there, so I see he's hiding under the table now because he's very apolitical. And, you know, I think he knows what I'm trying to say. I mean, if you look out in the future years, and maybe I can ask the commissioner then, because it's kind of going along with, you know, Representative Wiggins was saying, how bad do we really get out there in 08 and 09 when the pretend number with an asterisk is 704 million, but the real number might be, I don't know, is it 1.4, is it 2.3, is it, how many billion is it? And how, so when we have an asterisk for a pretend number, how much are we exacerbating the problem, Dr. Stinson, as we go along here without recognizing the old rules before the asterisk that we had to, should have, and we should consider inflation on the spending side also?
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, I don't have the exact numbers. Commissioner Higginson has got them written on her paper, but clearly you need to, in your own minds, take into account the fact that there is going to be inflation between now and 2008 and 2009. Now, there's also productivity growth. You know, that'll offset some of it, but it just seems reasonable to be thinking in your own minds that this is going on. And kind of the question is, or the statement that I would have for you is, you know, don't fool yourself that this is the true extent of the budget pressures that you have, that the budget pressures are larger than that.
Representative Carlson.
Actually, my question was along the same line. I wasn't thinking so much of the asterisk, but I did have a question, and apparently it's of the commissioner then and not Dr. Stinson. How much red ink is there for the next biennium if we were to include inflation, since we did get a sneak preview that you might have them written on a piece of paper there? And then secondly, what inflationary rate as a result of the discussion that Representative Lagunias was having earlier are you using with whatever number you have there?
Commissioner Ingerson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, there actually is information in a couple of places. If you wanted to talk about the chart that's on the bottom of page 5 that looks at the outlook in 08-09, or and actually if you look at the summary document, the information is on page 9, and the blue stripe document you'll see on page 9, the information there. But Mr. Chairman and members, this document, the chart here shows that what has changed since November. So there's been some improvement. We're actually looking at combined for 08-09 a balance of a little over $700 million compared to just under $500 million in November. But clearly, as noted on page 9, what happens if you use the inflation assumptions, as we have historically done, the CPI numbers estimated for 2008 and 2009, you actually have a compounding effect of inflation over the entire four-year period. So 06-07 and 08-09 gives you around $2 billion in would add about $2 billion to the spending. And I think, Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, other members that have been engaged in the discussion, you point out that there is inflation affects revenues positively, and so we have some inconsistency when we don't show inflation on the spending side. Therefore, we think it's important to note it and make sure that people understand the effect of inflation adding to the pressures. As we've noted in the documents, and on page 9, it has the specific number adding about $2 billion to spending if inflation is compounded over the four-year period.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm trying to understand that $2 billion now, and with what you just said, if we project it over the four-year period, so does that $2 billion reflect the upcoming biennium as well as the out biennium, so that it's a total of $2 billion, or is it some number higher than the $2 billion when we talk about 4 years?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, you actually would have $700 million in the 06-07 biennium, the upcoming, and then compounding that onto 08-09, you'd have an additional $2 billion. So looking at that over the four-year period, compounding. And, you know, Mr. Chair and members, even in the days when we included inflation on the forecast, inside the forecast in the numbers, we would point out to people that there is this, when we make assumptions over a four-year period and we have the compounding, you have the tendency to maybe overstate the effect of inflation. And so, I mean, certainly we don't think that it makes sense to ignore inflation and to not and why we highlight this, but this is an unusual time when we're in the process of setting a budget, and then we're also looking at planning estimates for the out biennium. The inflation numbers for 8-9 get more relevant when you have a budget proposal for 06-07 rather than assuming that there's 4 years of compounding basically unchecked for 4 years.
And
Representative Carlson,
if I may, just so I get this straight now, we've got $2.7 billion, if I was following you correctly, when we compound that $700 million this biennium. Now, when I read your paragraph here, it talks about adjusting for inflation on the expenditure projections. So what is the net number then when we look at the revenue side, assuming that there's got to be one or the other, some growth or some decline? Let's assume you've looked at that as well.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, inflation is inherent already in these numbers on the revenue side because it's related to that economic growth, and as Tom Stinson described, the way we collect our revenues, it's it's really built into the revenue side of the equation.
Yeah, I understand it's built into the revenue, so I just want to make sure then that when I talk to various folks about the red ink, that I'm using the right numbers. So am I, in your professional opinion, using the right number when I talk about the next 4 years then that we are $2.7 billion short?
No, you're not.
No.
Because you had the $490 million and the $700
Okay, so what I'm trying to do is get that net number then. So what is the net number?
Mr. Chairman, if you wanted, Representative Carlson, if you wanted to look at 6, 7, 8, 9, and I, in the way that I think you want to talk about red ink over 4 years, I don't think it's appropriate because I don't think that you want to make the assumptions that there's not going to be, that there's going to be no action between now and the end of the 4 year period. But if you wanted to make that calculation, I think you look at the $400 million, $466 gap in 06-07, add $700 to that, look at the balance of $700 million in 08-09, and subtract from that additional $2 billion in inflation.
Okay, so... Okay, now I think I'm with you. But now you made another comment, Mr. Chairman, that you say, but yeah, I wouldn't want to do that because there will be changes. But don't we always talk about the budget under current law?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, that's right. But I think that the assumption is that you're not going to balance the budget this biennium. And that's how you get to the numbers in 08-09. And I just don't think that that's a realistic assumption. I think it's appropriate to talk about what your plans are in balancing the budget for the 06-07. And once you have a plan for that, then to build in a planning estimate for 8 and 9 rather than to assume no action for 4 years on the budget gap.
Commissioner, as I was looking at this, as I recall, in the November forecast, there was a $700 million deficit, and then there was something like $700 million additional that we thought would have been added to the deficit if we had taken inflation into account. Now, if we, if you assume that the governor's budget was adopted, and I look at the February forecast, it looks to me like there is a little bit over $700 million in structural balance in 08-09 on the February forecast. Is it fair to say that we are roughly structurally balanced if we pass the governor's budget because we would have an additional $700 million that wasn't showing in inflation in 08-09, but then we also have roughly $700 million in additional revenues on the bottom of line projected for 08-09?
Mr. Chairman, I think you're getting close. I'm close to having an understanding and an analysis to be able to agree with that point. We haven't calculated the full effects of this forecast on the governor's budget recommendations, but with the adoption of the governor's budget, we looked at the implications in 08-09, and it was within $100 million of being balanced, structurally balanced in 08-09, including the effect of inflation. Now, inflation is just slightly higher in this forecast in 8 and 9 than it was at that time. And we also, as I mentioned, we're in the process of repricing the cost of the governor's budget proposals under new assumptions coming out in the forecast. But I think I'm close to being able to agree with your point there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
Sometimes I feel like a shark when I see blood or when they see blood or something. You know, I've got to get this straight now. So we have, Commissioner, what Representative Carlson said, we have the 2.7 over the 4 years for inflation, plus we have the $466 million, and plus we have the $704 million. And that would give us at least an honest picture of what we could be in debt if we don't, as you said, cut the, you know, not have the $466 billion balanced for this biennium, and then figure out how we're going to take care of that in the next biennium as far as tails. But we don't seem to be very good at it because you know, as you mentioned in the chart that's up there now, or the one that was before, a little change in forecast spending, we, even after all the cutting and everything else we did and not counting inflation, we had to pass a deficiency bill to balance the budget this year of $31 million, most of which was dealing with regional treatment centers and correction beds and public defenders. Now we have a lot of new things coming online. That was about $26 million of the $31 million, I think, Mr. Showalter. And I'm not, you know, nowhere near an economist, but I can't balance a checkbook, but I'm just going by memory what came through here. Then you're
be careful, Representative Rukavina. We don't allow people who can't balance their checkbook to be on the Ways and Means Committee.
You no longer have a quorum.
Why, no one's here, Mr. And then your deficiency bill tails, you're saying, is 43, but I just really have a tough time, Commissioner, accepting that number, given the fact that we were off so much this year, and thinking, and not only in covering the to the end of the 05 biennium, but thinking that we had solved the out years, and it, you know, we just got this huge cottage industry that I call it in the whole corrections arena, and you're not counting for a lot of that stuff that's coming online, but we also have the one-time spending, which I don't know how we get rid of tails with one-time spending. And maybe you've got to explain that to me here on Ways and Means as a veteran of this committee, because we had one-time tobacco money we used, then we had one-time health care access money we used, and we had one-time, but we used them over a few years. I think we took money from Workers' Comp Special Fund, Mr. Chair, and other special funds, and Representative Gunther's budget, and displaced workers' monies, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm really fearful that the numbers we're seeing here tonight might not even be as rosy as they are without the inflation, Representative Carlson. So help me, calm me down.
Commissioner.
Calm me down, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman.
Don't show blood. Don't, I'm like a shark seeing blood. Don't show, you know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, to give you some comfort, maybe, this is a forecast. And obviously, there are many things in the forecast we make assumptions about. We make a lot of assumptions about, and whether it's inflation, and we have the reliability of our information from the national economists, or whether it's revenue assumptions, or whether it's on our spending programs. There are lots of assumptions that go into this forecast that we can talk about. And I think that what we've done is given you here in this forecast our best estimate under current law of what to expect in the next four-year period. I cautioned about the use of the description of 4 years of red ink and a combined number, because I don't believe that you're going to leave here this session without resolving the budget problem in the upcoming biennium. And so I think that it gets to be a little bit unrealistic assumption, but this is a projection, our best estimate of what will occur over the next 4 years under current law, assuming no changes. And that's where I get concerned about the use of that 0809 numbers, assuming you're not going to make changes, because I believe that you are going to. And Mr. Chairman, Representative Rukavina, you talk about the things that have occurred in the past to bring things, what we have relied on to bring the budget for this current two-year period into balance. And there's no question that there were a lot of things that are poor financial management things in the long haul. And I think that people made choices. What are less desirable actions? What we're telling you is that it's important to look at what the risks are over the next four-year period, and we're talking to you about the risks in the economy and the risks to the assumptions that we're making in this forecast, and we think that a very prudent goal is to balance your budget for 06-07, regardless of how you do it, so that when you look at the effect of that budget in 08-09, that you're covering, that you've got revenues to cut adequate to cover your expenses plus any estimates that you'd make about spending pressure related to inflation. And we think that that's a reasonable kind of prudent thing to do so that you don't run into these problems. So there always will be things that we'll be surprised about, either on the upside or the downside on the revenue and spending side. There are more inmates than we expected, so that we are dealing with this. We have had to deal with this deficiency bill. We're building in and we're explaining to you in our documents what our assumptions are in all of these areas on spending and revenues going forward. And as we talked about the effect of the governor's budget recommendations in the next biennium, the goal is to set your budget for 06-07 knowing that you've got revenues adequate to fund adequately exceeding revenue or expenditures in the next biennium, and your comfort level with what other kind of spending pressure and inflation there is.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Rickabia, we've got, if we stick with our normal meeting time, we've got 11 minutes left in the meeting, and I would like to have them have a chance to finish up with their presentation. Can you maybe ask one last question?
One quick question, and I have to apologize because I have to leave for a 4 o'clock meeting, but I just have to say this, that, you know, Commissioner Engelson, I've always liked you. You know, that ever since you were a Senate staffer, you're so bright and you know your stuff. And, you know, I think at one time you might have been a Democrat. I know you were an independent, and now you might be a Republican. So let me just throw this question at you before I leave. Arne Carlson has stated a couple times recently that we have a structural problem in our revenue and spending, and it relates back to the 2001 tax bill, which we never paid for. Would you, as a all-over-the-board politician and being nonpartisan, agree with that at all?
Commissioner. Mr. Chairman and Representative Rukavina, I think what I'd like to do is just kind of talk about this in the whole structural question that you raised. We have in the past done things that have been using one-time revenues to take care of ongoing expenses, and that's kind of the problems that occur going forward is that you don't have that revenue keeping pace with the spending. I think that I'd like to talk a little bit about structural being much more broadly and not a point in time. I mean, what happens is we tend to look at these budgets as we have in this forecast to say, here's this biennium and here's this biennium, but structural kind of makes the assumption that your budget is dynamic and not static, and you need to have revenues meet your spending needs on an ongoing basis, on a day-to-day basis. And so, you know, when we talk about the structural gaps, certainly use of one-time funds to fund ongoing spending is a problem, and we have a structural problem. When we try to look forward, we've got revenue growth that is assumed in this budget, and we've got healthy, in some cases, revenue growth built in and even higher spending growth. And we've got a couple of areas of our budget where the spending is well in excess, the rate of spending growth is well in excess of any of our revenue sources growth. So, you know, there are assumptions that you can make about we are going to, as Tom Simpson talked about, look at opportunities for improving productivity, whether it's in our state employee expenses or our use of technology or the things that we're doing that we don't want to see grow as fast, but we still have a few areas of the budget where there's just we'd be unable to, with any of our revenues, meet the same rate of growth. So we have to look at this overall and see what we're expecting in revenue growth and spending growth, even once we get things into balance on a current basis, accounting for the things that we've done in the past that were one-time items, really kind of bringing these things into balance on an ongoing basis, not simply a point in time, which is what happens whenever we balance the budget. We balance it for this biennium. What we have to do is look at bringing things together in an ongoing basis.
Okay, Representative Hilty. And I really want to be able to have Commissioner Engelson finish this off. Is your question related to this?
Yes, it is, Mr.
Okay.
Chair. It's very brief.
Go ahead.
Commissioner, I have followed all of this recent give and take, is what you're saying is that the bottom line, the only way it is possible, given the administration's having taken any enhanced revenues off the table, the only way it would be possible to balance the budget in this biennium is to cut it by $1.1 billion approximately.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilty, I didn't mean to suggest that, and certainly the governor's budget recommendation has a lot of revenues included in it. It's not $1.1 billion in spending cuts. There are reallocations, and there is new spending, and there is, in fact, in the governor's budget recommendations, revenues being brought to bear as part of the budget solution.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, as far as I'm aware, the governor's budget resolution doesn't take into account that $700 million in inflation that we're facing in this biennium.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilty, one of the things that I think this question raises is the importance of, I've made the case for the importance of looking at inflation as part of your forecast, but when you are making your budget decisions, it's a factor to give consideration to, but I would say that the governor is funding inflation in places that are priorities where he doesn't like the impact of not including inflation. And so, in fact, his budget proposal, you will examine, I suppose, the effects of where there are places where inflation is absorbed and where there's new funding added.
Okay, Commissioner, let's see if we can let you finish off the rest of your presentation here.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Jim Showalter was just going to talk a little bit more about the spending. And,
Mr.
and
Showalter.
Actually, the last chart, Mr. Chair, we probably could skip, so this could be the end, because we kind of had an earlier discussion about 0809.
Sure. Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members, the last chart is the second to last one in your package. It notes that there's little change in forecast spending. As you know, in any February forecast or November forecast, we look at changes in revenues as well as changes in spending. We've been talking predominantly about changes in revenues so far. That married up with the changes in spending gets you the forecast. In this instance, there's very little changes in spending from the November estimates. For 2004 and 5, the spending is up about $6 million. In 2006 and 7, there's no net change. Despite the very little net change, there are some elements that are going up, some elements that are going down. In general, I think it's fair to characterize that there's no significant changes in program participation or significant changes in population or demographic changes. However, there are some smaller issues that I'll go through very quickly. The key issue in changes in spending, both biennium, is the passage of the 2005 deficiency bill. That increases spending in 2005 by about $31 million. That's included in the numbers that you see in the forecast. That spending is also included for the ongoing effects of that bill in the 2006 and 7 biennial numbers as well. The increase in 2004 and 5 is net by some savings in human services, K-12 and other areas, leaving the net $6 million increase. In 2006 and 7, that increase associated with the deficiency bill is added to with the increases in spending in the K-12 area, predominantly related to changes in the way that schools are reporting the number of children eligible for free and reduced lunches, the adding along with some changes in the estimates of the number of Hmong immigrants that are likely to be enrolled in our schools this upcoming school year. That adds about $44 million. Those costs were offset by changes in the human services area. Some of that is changes in underlying forecast. Most of it, however, is changes associated with delays in the anticipated implementation of the health map system, an eligibility determination system, along with some decreases in anticipated number of Minnesota Care enrollees. What that does essentially, is delays the cost shift from the Health Care Access Fund into the general fund as we anticipate some people who are currently in Minnesota Care program moving into GAMC or the Medical Assistance Program, which are found in the general fund. That is the spending story in a nutshell. As Commissioner Ingerson mentioned earlier, we are currently repricing the governor's budget so that we have a better understanding of what the impact of this forecast is on his proposals as well.
Well, Mr. Showalter, you mentioned Minnesota Care. You know, it's kind of striking to me that when you look at the deficiency bill, I mean, we would have had, you know, we would have come in with $25 million less spending in this biennium and another $43 million less spending in the next biennium without that. Obviously, we needed to pass that bill, but that's striking. Is that, and I see on here you say human services spending savings is the lion's share of it, but does that include health care too, or is it really just human services?
For the 2004 and 5?
For either.
For both, for the most part, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, for both it's predominantly health care. In 2004 and 5, there's a $16 million or $15 million change in cancellations that's associated with the mental health system. We were talking earlier about the regional treatment centers and the delay in moving those services out to the community. I hate to bring it back to this topic, but there was some money that was allocated to try and make that transition. It's not likely to happen on time. As a result, that money is canceling, and it's likely to have to be sought for 2006.
Okay. Representative Dorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. I had to step out of the room. Also, it would strike me that some of the flattening of the spending would be occurring because we've shifted some of the cost to the property tax system, and we're getting the dollars for some of the services, some there. And I'm wondering, I know we had this discussion in a previous meeting, do you have a calculation yet for the bottom line amount of increase in property taxes in the governor's proposal, throughout his budget proposal? I think we had asked about that last time.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dorn, I think I provided that information with the governor's budget proposal, but I'm assuming that there might be some change. I'm not sure, actually, if there are changes in the property tax assumptions as a result of this forecast. But we may have that information within another day or two.
And Mr. Chair, if I might,
Representative Dorn,
I apologize. I just am making connecting with what I heard before I left the room a half hour ago. Within the spending assumptions, does that include then? Would we be back at a 90-10 shift in terms of K-12 within this spending assumption, or would that shift still be at about 84, whatever it was?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dorn, the assumptions kind of going forward into the next biennium is that the payment shift is at the 84.3, and the settle-up payment is 15.7%.
And Mr. Chair, I have back when I came in, a lot of the shifts had occurred. And then I voted to increase the spending to undo some of the shifts, and then, you know, the criticism was there, we're spending at more than the rate of inflation, but if you've got shifts to pay back, you are going to be, you know, increasing some spending if you're trying to make up for what you had to do in the tough years. I think you had said that was about $350 million that is still there. If to get up to 90 would take another $350 million. In shift, are there other shifts that would still be in place in this forecast of for 08 and 09?
Commissioner,
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Dorn, this forecast is all under current law. So the only assumption that really kind of changes here as a result of the forecast is that school aid payment shift. The law, the triggers in law apply, and as I mentioned, kind of set that goal of getting to the 90% payment. But in addition, there's still property tax recognition shift on the education, and that still is a part of the trigger, and that's a little over $300 million, $337 million to deal with that property tax recognition shift. That's kind of a changing number because it relates to the property taxes. But this is another of the triggers in law that is expected kind of repay. The law initially talked about if there's forecast balances, money first goes to restore the cash flow account, build up the budget reserve, and then take care of both of these payment shifts in education, both the payment and the property tax recognition part of it.
Okay, thank you.
And Representative Carlson, last question, and then we will adjourn.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, but I couldn't help but note after your checkbook comment, you're down to six members. but Rukavina did have his red pen, so he was...
Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
my question, and it can be one I can answer very briefly.
Representative Carlson, truth must be told that my wife does our checkbook on our computer.
That helps. my question, Mr. Chairman, goes back to a discussion we had earlier, and I'm just wondering where in this document it shows up or how it shows up, and that's the HESO expenditures. We had some discussion about the $32 million in unused financial aid appropriation, and now I understand... I haven't got anything official, but I keep hearing that that's maybe growing by another 10 or 12 million by the time the second year of the biennium is done. I don't know if that's accurate, but let's go back to the 32 million. And where does that appear, or is that at the end of the biennium that comes onto the books as saved dollars?
Commissioner. Or Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there aren't adjustments in this forecast for the state grant program. There is was some discussion that the spending might be slightly lower than originally anticipated, but the cancellation estimate, which is where we would find that, was not adjusted because we felt like the change from the November forecast was relatively small and was probably the level of certainty wasn't sufficient to make an adjustment.
Yeah, then, Mr. Marks is just pointing out to me it's the same as November then at 39 million. I think that may have included reciprocity as well. Yeah, that's where I get the 32, and then I think it was 7, so 39, but I hear informally at least that number may be growing. But when will we find that out then, when the books are closed or...
Mr. Showalter.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that certainly when books are closed in fall, we would know for certain. I think they are still anticipating some enrollment information yet this year. So in the coming months, I would assume there's even some more timely information. For purposes of state budgeting, the February forecast would be our last look at it officially.
Officially, so there wouldn't be any additional information other than what we can solicit from them currently. The HESO agency as to what their final number may be.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Well, with that, members, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you, Commissioner, Mr. Showalter, Dr. Stinson.
Thank you.
Thank you.